Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This podcast is for listeners who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean to learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi, a PhD candidate at Princeton University. Today, we are here to talk about the volume, Histories of Health and Materiality in the Indian Ocean World, Medicine, Material Culture, and Trade between 1600 to 2000, published by Bloomsbury in 2023. And here we have one of the co-editors, Professor Anne Griston, who is a professor of history at the University of Warwick in the UK and chair of Asian art at the University of Leiden in the Netherlands. At Warwick, she co-directs the Global History and Culture Center. The volume is also co-edited by Professor Burton Cletus, who is an assistant professor of history at Jawaharlal Nehru University in India, where he teaches modern Indian history. He specializes in the history of medicine and science and has worked on the institutionalization of Indian medical traditions in colonial and post-independent India. Welcome, Professor Anne, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thanks so much for taking the time to talk about the book today.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm delighted. Thank you.
My honor. So the volume Histories of Health and Materiality in the Indian Ocean World introduces materiality into the study of the history of medicine. This volume hones in on communities across Indian Ocean world and explores how they understood and engaged with health and medical commodities, opening up spatial dimensions and challenging existing approaches to knowledge, power, and the market. It defines therapeutic commodity and explores how different materials were understood and engaged with in various settings and for a number of purposes, offering new spatial realms within which the circulation of commodities created new regimes of meaning. Histories of Health and Materiality in the Indian Ocean World demonstrates how medicinal substances have had immediate and far-reaching economic and political consequences in various capacities, from midwifery and umbilical cords to the social spaces of soap and perfumes in early modern India and remedies for leprosy. This volume considers a vast range of material culture in medicinal settings to better understand the history of medicine and its role in global connections since the early 17th century to the present century. We would like first, before we delve into the book, to learn about yourself. If you can share a few words about where you were born, where you went to school, how you became interested in your field of study, and if you would like to mention any mentors you had along the way.
Thank you. Sure. Yeah. So I grew up in the Netherlands. My name, Anne Gerritsen, maybe suggests that already. And I went to school in the Netherlands, and I went to the kind of school where you had to do a lot of different languages, and I enjoyed languages, or in fact, I was only good at languages. I wasn't good at anything else. So I did 6 languages and history in my final exam year. And when I went to the States, I then decided to do just a year of undergraduate study there. I added Chinese and Japanese. And so I rolled into area studies, and I did then Chinese at Leiden University, or Chinese Languages and Civilizations, as it was called then, from an interest of the language. And area studies gave me an opportunity to learn everything to do with China. And I want to come back to that a bit later on, but area studies as a kind of subject is quite interesting to me. It's quite different from the discipline that I work in now. But anyway, so I did Chinese studies at my undergraduate, which in the Netherlands then also involved an MA degree. And then I went to the States to do a PhD, and that was also in area studies. So I went to Harvard, and I went to the East Asian Languages and Civilizations Department, and I studied early modern Chinese. I mean, it wasn't called early modern there. It was called Song Dynasty, and Song Yuan Ming was the topic of my PhD as a time period, which is about, you know, the 10th century up to maybe 1650, roughly speaking. And all my expertise really and my academic conversations were with other China specialists. I moved to the UK after that, and by luck for me, I guess, I was able to secure an appointment in a history department, because that history department, which is the University of Warwick, where I still teach today, was quite interested in having people with area expertise. It's a little bit unusual, and when I got that job, which was in 2001, I know that's a very, very long time ago, I was lucky enough that the department had lots of historians, but it also recognized the significance of linguistic skills. So it had also other area experts who worked on India, including, for example, at the time, David Hardiman. And I joined as a China specialist, and I taught early modern China. But you mentioned the Global History Center. I'm actually no longer the director. Guido van Meersbergen, another Dutch colleague, is now the director. We established the Global History Center in 2007. And it was an attempt then to try and make the field of history, particularly in the UK, but it tapped into interests in other parts of the world, more global, meaning crossing boundaries, doing away with the very conventional limitations set by area. And that was a trend that was quite broad. I mean, there was interest in it in part because, for example, the publication of various books, actually. I mean, there are, you know, the standard books that we always hear about that are sort of formative in global history. But the interest in the Warwick History Department was really in trying to bring together people who work on India, people who work on China, people who work on Latin America, people who work on different time periods, so not necessarily just a focus on globalization and a kind of, you know, late 20th century interest in what happens to institutions and powerful, you know, organizations and commercial development. So it had an interest in the early modern, and because of the people who were involved in it, and that included Maxine Berg and Giorgio Riello as some of my closest colleagues, but also by then the University of Warwick had hired David Arnold, another great South Asian specialist from SOAS, to come and join the history department. And together we had quite a strong interest in both colonial and post-colonial worlds and in material culture. And all of these things, and we'll come back to that in a moment, I'm sure, tie into what this volume has become. So that interest in material culture for me personally, in terms of my scholarly development, was initially focused mostly on China. And I published my PhD book, which was on Song Yuan Ming, religion and local culture. And my second book, which came out only fairly recently, in 2020, The City of Blue and White, focused on porcelain and the global trade in porcelain. So these strands are all part of what this book is, partly an interest in area studies and knowing the area well through linguistic skills, but also looking beyond the boundaries of the area, having an interest in the structures of power, you know, of course, politics and imperial and colonial structures that shape life, but looking also at material culture and trade and across the early modern boundary. And I think those are all themes that are part of my interest. Our research interests at Warwick, our particular type of global history that we do at the University of Warwick, continue to do in different ways, and part of what this volume has become. So that's, to my mind, a little bit of the sort of background of who I am and where I came from.
Thank you for sharing that. I've noticed recently there is a growing interest in bringing materialism and material culture to the study of the Indian Ocean world, works such as by scholars as Elizabeth Lamborn or Nancy Ohm. Brought these methods into reading different sorts of sources, whether they are the objects themselves or how they are contextualized in historical texts. In your case, you've worked on China, as you've mentioned, and its material culture. And in this volume, you bring in the material or the material culture to the study of health and medicine in the Indian Ocean world. In your opinion, as you discuss in your introduction with Professor Burton Cletus, what are the rewards of bringing such a method and field of study to other fields such as health and medicine?
Yeah, very good question. I mean, what are the rewards? I think the rewards are that you tap into a different set of sources, as you already said. And I think Elizabeth Lamborn and Nancy Ohm are excellent examples of doing just that for the field of history. I mean, art history and history are then often quite closely tied in together. But I think the main reward is that it adds a set of materials which are not necessarily as connected to the conventional sources that we know. So, you know, particularly for the early modern period, the East India companies, the kind of European colonial presence, we know their presence, we know their role. But looking at materials, I think, so objects, the objects themselves, or the documents that are associated with those objects, I think what it allows us to do is to add a different set of agents and actors into the picture. And I think objects, I mean, that's worth discussing if this time, or to think about for listeners, whether objects have agency. And I think it's worth considering and taking that seriously. But I think it also adds different geographies. So the spaces that we conventionally look at the sources that we're very familiar with tie us into pre-established or established, in fact, through those very sources, political boundaries, limitations, borders of one kind or another, whether these are cultural or human or political. I think the objects have different geographies. They travel in different ways. They push through different boundaries. They have different temporalities because the histories of objects remain kind of inscribed on them in a different way from how a document also, of course, has chronological layers attached to it. But most people who read an object read the text and then tie that into where that text originated. Whereas with an object, you can't just look at where it originated or where it was manufactured. You have to follow its traces. You have to, as the way labor historians call it, or you have to look at its biography, as object historians have often drawn on anthropologists' work, of course, including Appadurai. But it opens up different trajectories, and those are part of the story of the object and therefore allow us to tell different stories. And I think history has been doing that for a longer time than the field of medicine or the historians of medicine. I think they have been interested. I mean, I'm not suggesting that no one has ever looked at material culture in the field of the history of medicine, particularly in the kind of you know, colonial exploits that include plants and animals. Of course, people have looked at the natural world, and that ties in with science and technology, sure. But I think taking a material culture approach allows you to also zoom into not just generic plants or types or types of objects, but into individual object, a specific desk or a specific ceramic pot that held medicinal substances, or you know, things like that. So it opens up, I think, different actors, different sources, different spatial connections, and that's an important dimension to me, because I think it also opens up the Indian Ocean to some extent. But anyway, that may be getting ahead of myself a bit there, but those would, I would say, the rewards of bringing in material culture.
Excellent. So the edited volume is divided into 13 chapters, including the introduction. I would like to know, how did this volume come about? What was the impetus for it and the organizational work that the editors have undertaken?
Yeah, thank you. Well, it's a long history, and I talk a little bit about that in various places in the volume, not least, of course, because of COVID. But it started actually... It had a quite long trajectory. It started with some funding from the Wellcome, which funds, of course, a lot of activities in the field of the history of medicine and medical humanities. And I initially set out when I applied for that funding to try and think about the connections between India and China. And I really wanted to bring together a kind of South-South connected story that brought scholars who work on China and scholars who work within the Indian Ocean, and particularly in South Asia, together in conversation to think about how medical substances were traded within that world. So trying both to expand the Indian Ocean world, which often has very specific, broad but still quite specific geographies, and the scholars who work on China, who are equally limited within a very specific spatial realm. And while I was very pleased, again, it was only seed funding, it was enough for two workshops, three actually. We also had a final one in the UK, but just because of practicalities and different aspects of it, we ended up having one in China and one in India at JNU in Delhi. And the group of people who got involved in both of those were basically not so much talking to each other, but still quite focused on, you know, one group of China scholars, and that's a different volume that's coming out separately, and one group of scholars who are still largely focused on the Indian Ocean world, which is why that's also ended up in the title. And some of that ambition that I originally had, I just had to let go. But there are still traces in the volume of that attempt to open it up more broadly and not to just think of an Indian Ocean world dominated by very specific groups in indeed India and Europe, as it's often conceived. So the traces in the volume that show an attempt at opening up the Indian Ocean world more broadly. So the organizational work that you asked us about, Burton and I set out to try and be as inclusive as we could of all the participants at the workshop. Not every single person was able to contribute, but quite a lot of the papers that we had selected for being presented there did find their way in their volume. And I say that partly because we ended up working with quite a few very early career scholars or even still PhD students, which was, you know, joyful and really exciting to do. But during COVID specifically, that slowed things down quite significantly, because when everything was extraordinarily difficult for PhD students, particularly students who I would have felt, I mean, I don't know how you feel about that, had an even tougher trajectory than most, having to do work in a limited amount of time and having to make do with the possibilities they had. So COVID undoubtedly made this somewhat more challenging, but we did, I feel, put together a volume that showed the range, and we tried to then organize those papers somewhat chronologically. And I think you can see that for some, this was really something that responded well to this idea of, you know, take material culture, draw on material culture as a methodology and bring it into the history of medicine. And others took a very broad view of what that material culture methodology might be, or actually really focused on their own world and tried to open it up and look beyond and trace some of these substances and some of these ideas even beyond that. So the end result that you see before you has, I think, traces of all of those histories, as all volumes always do. They are different from a monograph in that sense that it's just one person's trajectory. I think you see here, you know, how about, you know, 12 people or so struggled with very particular circumstances. And I'm just very pleased at the wide range that we are able to present in the volume here.
Right. And it really shows in covering such a vast period and geography, which allows the researcher to explore different areas in the Indian Ocean world, whether thinking about circulation or market integration or consumption of certain medical substances and commodities. In these chapters, what are the deployed methods and approaches in integrating material culture into the study of health and medicine?
Yeah, good question. So for me, the material culture approach is one that says an object isn't one thing and isn't in a kind of essentialized and static entity, but something that changes over time. So it's something you need to contextualize, and you need to think about how and why it gets defined in a certain way or gets given meaning in a certain way. And I think if you do that over time and space, then that alone is already quite a challenging exercise. I try to grapple with that in my chapter on rhubarb, but if you look at several of the studies that take an individual medical substance or something like what Amrita Chattopadhyay does with perfumes, you know, it's trying to say this is not something that at the outset we already know what it is and we're going to follow its traces, but instead we say, who is defining it in that particular way? Yeah, take Chalmugra, for example, or any of the Ayurvedic drugs. And how does it actually get defined? And for what reason does it matter for people to define it in that way? And when I say people, I mean also institutions. And when you look at that across time, you see that institutions pop up, especially in the kind of 19th and 20th century, with their own interests and agendas to define these substances in a very particular way. And then it can bring to light very interesting power relationships between who gets to define a medical substance, who gets to say, this is what it is, this is how it works, and this is the element of that substance that we want to capture for our own purposes, and who gets to say whether we can or not. And that brings then to light all of those who have something at stake, and that includes often the local population, who have a kind of knowledge accumulated over a very long time, but not necessarily, although sometimes it is, codified knowledge or legally protected knowledge. And then, of course, in quite a lot of these stories, there are the colonial agents in some way or another trying to capture the benefit for it, especially, as you said, in that commercial dimension, when there are substances that are, you know, possibly money-making substances. But of course, those who take it into a more, even more contemporary element, and I'm thinking, for example, of the chapter by Kaushiki Das, which talks about bio-prospecting, biopiracy, bioresources. It's not just the colonial agents and the local population or the indigenous knowledge that is at stake here. It's also the state government. It's the various institutions that try and codify these substances. It's commercial companies. It's commercial companies based in in the West, let's say, but multinational quite often. It's also Indian national institutions and Indian government, state government, national government, that all try to get in on the act. And it's the conflict that arises over that, which at heart is a conflict over ownership, possession, and therefore relies on methods of defining those substances that come to the surface in that way. So I think in each of the cases, we have material culture as a kind of method, but material culture doesn't exist in a kind of void. And I mean, not to be denigrating about art historians, of course, their art historians work in very sophisticated ways with material culture. But I think when historians work with material culture, they of necessity have to apply other kind of methods. And those are methods of, you know, understanding power, look at power structures, looking at institutional history, looking at different forms of agency, looking at legal conflict, looking at the history of medicine in the way that historically medicinal substances are defined and codified and protected and change over time or adjusted in terms of their workings. So I think it's not material culture is not a method that stands in isolation here. It is used really as a methodological approach that enhances and opens up and reveals different aspects of the methodologies that historians conventionally use, including those of imperial and colonial history, of global history, of exploitations history that draw quite a few of the volumes also draw on anthropological methods. So I think it's a kind of web or network of methods in which material culture stands at the center and ties in with all of the other methods that historians working on the Indian Ocean are familiar with.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yes, indeed. In reading the chapters, we encounter a different set of sources ranging from indigenous sources to colonial sources covering this period. So I was wondering whether we observe different attitude and conceptualization of medical substances and health that really sets apart the indigenous versus the colonial, and whether there are intersections at some points when it comes to, let's say, commodifying and valuing medicinal substances, or bioprospecting happens to be a uniquely colonial let's say, phenomenon. So if you can compare and contrast how the indigenous versus the colonial have conceptualized and treated medical substances and viewed health.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. And I think putting it as the two of them at odds with each other, so indigenous knowledge and indigenous medicinal substances and the colonial world, then I think it creates a binary that's both sort of comforting and familiar and too simplistic. And I think quite a few of the chapters show that it is a more complicated story where both are implicated in different ways. And that's, you know, challenging, but also makes it more interesting. So I think the agents are not as set on a binary of indigenous and colonial, and not as on a binary of colonial and modernizing, or modernizing taking the role entirely of the colonial enterprise from, let's say, indigenous sources. And I think that comes through in quite a lot of the chapters. So, for example, Burton Cletus's chapter talks about the circulation of Ayurvedic drugs. It talks really about migrants who deal with problems that come to the service specifically when they have been moved forcefully to new areas to work, and where they are now working under a colonial regime. And the what is interesting is that, of course, they face a whole range of medical challenges. And these are medical challenges that we in contemporary language would identify as both somatic, but also mental health related. And they seek solutions for that across the board. So they are exposed to medicine. That's part of the new region that they have moved into, and where they are providing this enforced labor. They also write letters back home to say, how do I deal with these problems? And the exchange of letters forms the body of sources that Burton is working with. But it shows that they are not easily, the migrant workers who write these letters and the Vaidan who's returning the letters, not as simply defined as saying, you know, this is your indigenous medicinal practice, and this is what you must use. The reality is that it has to become some kind of blend, some kind of adaptation to the local world. And something comes out of that that is more blended and more hybrid, if you will. And I think that same kind of story of complex relationships that are not as easily separated into one and the other actually appears in quite a few of the sources. So Malavika Binney's article, I think, crosses that boundary. I think my story on rhubarb does. I think David Arnold's chapter on toxic trading also shows, in different contexts, that indigenous knowledge and indigenous ways of thinking about what is a health-providing substance and what is a dangerous or poisonous or toxic substance is mediated by the context. And Jane Buckingham's chapter on chalmugra also shows that none of these substances are static, as I said right at the start. So if you take a substance from one place and move it somewhere else, whether that is into a colonial world or into you know, a contemporary multinational world, that substance changes. That substance no longer has all of the context attached to it and becomes something different, has to be thought of as something different, and no longer is, you know, something pure or original. I think those words are somewhat meaningless. So looking precisely at the ways in which those connections get blurred, those identities get more layered, more complex, more challenging to identify between, let's say, the indigenous and the colonial colonial exploiter of those substances, or also you know, those who want to capture the commercial benefit over the course of the 20th century. Different agents are involved, and each of them try to identify what the substance is and capture the medicinal benefits of it, but struggle to do so entirely on their own terms. They have to negotiate with some of those other meanings that are attached to the object. And I think what your question beautifully lends itself to is to point to why material culture and the kind of technology or the methodology of using that as a technique to identify those different layers, to see how they become both layered on top of each other, but also in conflict with each other, how some erase other levels of meaning. That's, I think, where you see how useful material culture studies can be as a skill of looking at that, the complexities of the world that isn't one, that identifies one entirely separate world that is indigenous, and one entirely isolated layer on top of it that might be colonial, and one further layer on top of that that is doing away with both of those and is a kind of, you know, 20th, 21st century modern. None of that exists in separation or in isolation.
Indeed, thank you. That's really useful. Another maybe comforting binary in reading the history of medicine in the Indian Ocean world is that you have this contrast between colonial science or modern science versus so-called folk beliefs, religion, occult sciences, and magic, and in the way medical substances are made sense of and used and contextualized within certain cultures. So how do these chapters tackle this binary between the modern science or the colonial science and supposedly its rationality and objectivity in treating these substances versus the local, which is usually labeled as traditional and occult and so on?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really powerful question. And I think in many ways, the final chapter, I don't know if you had a chance to look at Harish Narayan Das's final chapter, which tackles that really, you know, in quite a maybe characteristic challenging way, I would say. He is, of course, a historian of medicine and based in anthropology as his discipline. And his chapter tackles precisely this kind of construction, I would say, of two worlds, one in which there is traditional folk medicine, or there is this kind of idea that there is a world in which that exists in isolation, as it were, and sometimes even a kind of timeless isolation, which is the conventional world or the traditional world or whichever word you want to use, and that exists in contrast with a modern, irrational, often associated with the Western world. And the contrast between the two comes up in many of the chapters, and in many of the chapters it's posted as a kind of conflict between power, or between, and that's commercial or political power, or power over a labor force, or power over the intellectual ownership, the sort of ways of defining it. In Harish Narayan Das's chapter, it features also as a kind of response to the emphasis on material culture in a kind of critical way. And so what Harish sets out to do is to, by presenting a number of vignettes at the start of the chapter, showing the different ways in which the separation is impossible between the two worlds. So the individual responses to treatment, the individual practices of the different therapists that are brought to the foreground in his chapter, all struggle with that binary, and all actually make it impossible to separate the two worlds. And what he is suggesting, that if we focus on material culture, and if we highlight the materiality of therapeutics, in other words, if we focus on those substances that can be identified as a material substance and therefore gain a name and a process, then by doing that, we are focusing on the biomedical world, and we are thereby actually also dismissing the value and power of the folk medicine, or traditional medicine, if you will, but which is a far more complex world in which, of course, there are also medicinal and therapeutic treatments, but the therapeutic treatments are much broader than that. They form a much wider complex of practices, of dietary practices, of spiritual practices, of routines and taboos, of timed periods in which you must follow certain guidelines. And by contrasting the material culture world with a conventional world in which those are not exclusively the therapeutic methods, he is kind of pushing those who have studied or have looked at material culture in the volume into the world of saying, you know, you are all dismissing the much more complex world of traditional therapeutics. And so his voice was actually quite a critical one, to say, actually, you know, you get a very asymmetrical production of pluralism, as he says in his title. You call it pluralism by opening up all these different options, but actually it's very asymmetrical. And by bringing in the material culture, you are actually creating that asymmetry that doesn't need to be there, that doesn't actually, that isn't part of those particular kind of settings, those vignettes that he creates. And I think, I mean, for me, it was a great pleasure working with Harish Narayan Das, having somebody so senior, somebody so experienced in the field of the history of medicine, somebody so critical of the various methods that we might have used, but so willing to have his voice included in this volume as a kind of counter voice to some of the other topics that we approached. I feel that that really adds something to the volume. And I think I don't know how easy it is for readers to pick up on the kind of counter voice that he's offering if they've been reading, you know, chapter 1 to 12. You know, that may come as a bit of a surprise, but I hope people continue to read into chapter 13 and see this contrasting voice and see that from an anthropological perspective, looking at the ways in which medicine works today, of course, he places that in a historical perspective. There are also some asymmetries that emerge out of this process. I mean, you know, I have an ongoing and very healthy and spirited conversation with him where I feel that that isn't necessarily the outcome and not necessarily the gist of how the chapters have dealt with that particular binary that you have proposed, that comforting, one of those many comforting binaries. But if anyone is interested, that's the chapter to read to see a sort of contradictory voice in the volume.
Great. Another, I would say, characteristic of the volume is that most of the chapters center South Asia in narrating the history of health and materiality. And as someone who's an expert on Chinese material culture, where do you see future directions in integrating Chinese studies of medicine and health and materiality with the rest of the Indian Ocean world, given, you know, the close connections between Chinese materia medica with the rest of the Indian Ocean worlds? Some scholars have started the work on looking at how Persian texts were translated into Chinese, and others are looking at shipwrecks. So do you see other future directions in which we can explore these connections between China with the rest of the Indian Ocean world?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was my original ambition, and you know, other things happened in the meantime, but it's still what I want to come back to try and create conversations that get people, again, out of their comfortable regional expertise. And I think the problem with it, exactly as you just said, is the linguistic skills. It really requires people who can read a very wide range of languages, but those people exist and will hopefully continue to exist, and they are and that isn't just about reading, let's say, Sanskrit and Chinese or Persian and Japanese, let's say. I think there are many other ways of doing it. And if we have some experts who can read all of the languages, we will also have opportunities for conversations between people who read some of those languages. And I think it's about opening up the geographical spaces. And I think Indian Ocean world, I think, needs to take account more, move somewhat more inland, perhaps, so including a little bit more of North Asia, which gets us into that very shared territory in which, you know, I mean, Central Asia, I think to claim that Central Asia is part of the Indian Ocean world may be a stretch, and I'm not suggesting that every ocean person also becomes somebody who does Central Asian studies, but I think it's a loss if we just close our eyes to the extent to which that those spatial connections existed. And that means also that the Indian Ocean world becomes blended with the Nanyang, the South China Sea and the South China Sea world. Those are not separate worlds. And those areas in which they meet as scholars of those areas know extremely well are blended areas in which these texts and substances and merchants and consumers are part of the same world. So my aim would still be to try and bring together people who work mostly on China but are willing to look beyond, and people who work mostly on, you know, on the Persian heritage but are also willing to look more towards China or South Asia and the Indian Ocean itself, of course. You know, that is already a massively diverse space in which we know all sorts of agents traveled, who leave traces, who are part of the landscape, who shape the coastal spaces around it. So I think these are conversations we need to keep having, and we need to keep being open-minded to the approaches that seem very embedded in those spaces. And when I say very embedded in those spaces, I mean, for example, in my experience, quite a lot of the people who work on South Asia specifically, even if you encourage them to think more broadly, and I say them because clearly I'm not an expert on South Asia, as you pointed out. I mean, I have no claim to say anything about that, but I do feel that it goes beyond saying that's really empire. If you ask somebody who works on South Asia to say look beyond the boundaries and think about something that's bigger than that, then they often go to empire and the agents of empire. And I think we can do better than that. I think there is more to be discovered there and more to be gained from those conversations that get us outside of the history of empire, which I personally feel, you know, I'm not suggesting it's not important, but it's not the only thing that exists. And for me, global history is really a methodology. Global history is really nothing about space and nothing about the entire globe. It's about looking for connections, identifying where the conflicts arise within those contested spaces. And that, I think, is a methodology that would create a different spatial realm and would open up spaces for conversations that include China, the Chinese linguistic world or the Sinophone world, as well as South Asia, as well as the Persian world. And it, you know, empire may be part of that, but may not be. That would be my view on that.
Yes, definitely. We need less of the empire, I guess.
Okay, good. I'm glad you agree.
And writing connected history, or even, you know, reimagining these histories away from these sorts of frameworks. And definitely the Indian Ocean world is not just a geographic container, as historians have shown. The frontiers of the Indian Ocean really extend as far as the ideas, languages, the commodities and peoples who are associated with the Indian Ocean and its cultures can, you know, be found. So in working on these chapters, have you came across any surprises, any, I don't know, head-scratching moments where you were like, wow, I didn't expect this, or this is really interesting, that you would like to share?
Lots of them, because for me, I was entering into such a different world. I mean, I think, I think probably mostly I would say the extent to which these substances traveled. I mean, you know, the chapter on Chalmugra, for example, finding ourselves in different parts of the world that I hadn't expected to travel in. And that's because if you bring a scholar from New Zealand over, then, you know, a whole different space turns up. The idea that you can take the bodies of convicts and think of those as actually material substances, that I found quite surprising. I thought the ways in which for me, again, as an outsider, as a tourist, as it were, or visitor in the world of South Asian medicine, the idea that, you know, the role of what is from apparently familiarly called tribal knowledge, which is a term that I wasn't familiar with in using, the way in which that continues to play through in today's political landscape of who owns some of these substances, who owns the knowledge, how do those bits of information get transmitted through very different political structures. There was lots of it. The idea that you could write a whole chapter on either perfumes or soap, or, you know, it has been a really exciting voyage of discovery for me, a very long way away from Chinese porcelain, that's for sure. Yeah.
Great. So who do you hope will read this book, and what sort of impact would you like it to have?
Oh, well, I hope Indian Ocean historians read it and think that they need to stretch out their geographies. I hope that historians of medicine will read it and think that they need to continue to and increase their familiarity with material culture studies. I hope that historians of empire will read it and think, no, actually, we don't need to keep repeating the British Empire structures. I hope that some historians of China will look at it and say, oh, that's interesting. One can, as a China historian, venture out into different fields. I hope that people will read it for the variety of elements in there and will recognize the work of some juniors, some very senior scholars, and will take away ideas for more research. I think there is really a world of sources that can be discovered, and that very interesting work can be done. And some of it does require linguistic skills, but some of it also is available in different versions and translations that make this really interesting material to work with, and that the history of medicine is not a hermetically closed world, but one that travels along global trajectories, I would say.
And I would add also, for graduate students, the rich bibliographies of each chapter are quite useful in exploring the field as well. Thank you so much. We've taken a lot of your time, and we've benefited a lot from this conversation. We would like to ask you the final question, which is, what are you working on now? Can you tell us about your current and future projects, or what you hope to work on?
Well, I already hinted that I would love to work more on this, but I haven't quite got a plan fixed on that continues this particular plan. I'm working on a chapter right now for a volume called Inland Empires, which is another challenge to the idea that empires have a very set pattern, that I think the concept of empire needs to be opened up and broadened out, and that various actors, indigenous agents, also form political structures that could be defined as empire, is a productive space to work in. And I'm very pleased that it brings together scholars who work on very different spaces, but including the Indian Ocean world. And I think it will be an interesting study, but that's just one of the chapters. I've mostly been writing quite varied chapters, and I haven't yet embarked on the thing that's going to occupy me for the next 10 years or so. So watch this space. It'll be, you know, I'll get there quite soon, I hope.
And we hope to have you back to the podcast to talk about these fascinating projects. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been great. Thank you.
And thank you for listening to today's episode, in which we explored with Professor Anne Khritsen histories of health and materiality in the Indian Ocean world, medicine, material culture, and trade between 1600 to 2000, published by Bloomsbury in 2023. This is your host, Ahmed Al-Mazmi. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.